Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
Howdy. How are you guys? How are you doing?
Howdy.
Howdy.
Hello.
Y'all.
Okay.
Salutations.
Oh my, we're already weird, huh?
Well, I don't know. Always have been.
If this is your first episode, we get it. You can turn it off.
Oh.
Try again next week.
All right. From the top?
Yeah.
All right. Hi. Hello. Holla. Okay, sorry, not better.
Oh god. All right, well, anyway, hey, how you guys doing?
How the hell are y'all? Welcome back to About Time for True Crime. Hey. Your favorite true crime podcast,
you guys.
Oh, we heart you. Today we are getting back to our roots, and by that I mean thematic, time-based, one or two-part episodes of true crime where one of us knows it all and the other one knows nada. Still nothing.
Yeah, what are we talking about today?
Wouldn't you like to know?
I would. Everyone else gets to kind of know because they read the title and get to pick it. I just sat here in my fat pants and said, okay, Abby, tell me something.
Story time.
Yay.
Today is about a Christmas family disappearance.
Ooh.
But before we get there.
Yeah.
If you guys are new today, we are just two best friends chilling it in the living room, kitchen, talking true crime. We're nerds. We love this stuff. We talk about it all the time. So we're like, what the hell? Let's hit record. And it worked out. So if you enjoy this podcast and our content and want to support us, you can do so by leaving a 5-star review, following and interacting with our profiles, and even donating. And you can find all of that in our link tree below.
You certainly can.
We hope you guys are having a great holiday season. And I just wanted to highlight a few things before we hop all the way into it. So the first is we got our Spotify Wrapped.
Yay!
Oh my gosh. And you guys, it's always so cool to see how we've grown and how many more seats are at the little ATFTC fam table, you know?
Yeah. We have so many chairs here.
Yeah. And it's just the two of us in the like physical room, but y'all are here too.
Oh no, you guys are here every week. We're just happy we get to hang out with you.
Yes. So it's always cool to see how many more people have decided to pop a squat.
I wish Spotify Wrapped would also tell you like, you listened in the car for 900 hours.
Yes.
You listened while you were in the shower doing this. You listened while you were getting ready. Like,
tell
it'd be
us.
Pretty invasive, but I'd like to know. So if you guys can tell us when you guys listen to your podcast, because I'm a true crime podcast girly through and through. I don't clean my house without it. I can't do laundry without it. Like, it's, I need to be distracted by something to get those necessary life things done. And it works great.
There's got to be something mentally stimulating for me to do literally any chore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we are just so grateful and I love it. And I don't know why. It's not related today and I don't claim to be a psychic, but it's just been weighing on my mind that I know as warm and fuzzy and happy as this time of year can be, it can be equally really dark and difficult and heavy for a lot of people. And we just wanted to remind you that the ATFTC fam would not be the same without you. And as your fam, we want you happy and healthy. So if you need any resources or support for mental health, I know this time of year can bring up a lot of mental health, but also grief and family and friend and health stuff and all of that good. Anything, just check out our Instagram. We have mostly mental health resources up, but like anything that's happening outside is happening in your brain too. So always worth looking at. And just remember to be gentle with yourself because we love you and the big sad does not discriminate. So
no, nope.
Anyway, that was my little, I was like, I have to say this. I feel it. I don't know why, but I feel it.
Of course you know why. It's because this time of year can suck for a lot of people too. It can, like, there's so much emphasis on being happy that I think it really highlights when you're not.
Yes.
Because it's, you're forced to. You walk into every store and it's like, be cheery. Don't you, it's cold outside. Stay here with me.
You better not pout. You better not pout.
You better not pout. You better not pout. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? I just think that like it can be lonely and tough, but we're getting through it. We're all doing it together.
Hell yeah.
Don't believe everything you see on social media. Do not compare yourself and have the best time that you can because, you know, we get one life. So
it's true. But speaking of our one life, how was your Thanksgiving?
I had a very lovely Thanksgiving.
Aww.
I'm very lucky. My first Thanksgiving married. Nothing was different. We've been together several years, but it was very good. We did like two Thanksgivings.
Nice.
Which was nice. And I didn't have to cook either of them. So it was even better.
Winning. Okay.
Yeah. And not to brag. But you wouldn't want to see what I would do to a turkey.
Oh, I'd
have
love
no,
to see what you do to a turkey.
No, because I have no idea.
You guys, Patreon idea. Would you or would you not watch a video of Allie trying to cook a turkey?
The answer should absolutely be no. Yes. Because I would cry. Be like, I'm so sorry. And I don't know what to do.
I love all the memes. There's like this page on Instagram called The Reductress. And it's just like satire news.
Yes.
And one of it's like, tofu's disgusting, says mom fisting a turkey for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, no, it's nasty.
Yeah, I wouldn't know where to start. I'm embarrassed to say it, but you know what, I know there's a lot of you listening that are like, I feel seen because I couldn't do it either. So you know what, this one's for you. Couldn't do it myself. But I did get to spend it with my parents and family and my husband's parents and family and everything, and it was just very lucky to have so many amazing people in our lives. So I'm very grateful for them and for our listeners, and just very thankful and
grateful and
thankful and all the synonyms for grateful. Those things. Yes. Yeah. And you better not pout. And you better not pout.
You better not pout. You better not pout.
How about you? How was your Thanksgiving?
It was so good. The entire Abel Dabbleson clan came out to see me.
Yeah, they did.
Has not yet happened for a holiday out here. So that was really cool.
Not to brag, but I got to hang out with Mr. and Mrs. Abel Dabbleson.
Oh, ow.
So just saying.
Yeah. So that was very fun. That was very good. We got to hang out and have some downtime, but also like go and look at some cute stuff and do fun things. We saw Wicked. And no, I won't be as obnoxious as I feel about it, but it is incredibly good and I recommend it, especially if you've seen the Broadway or off-Broadway, like the theater version of it.
Mm.
It's very fun. There's a lot of cool nods to like the stage play, which I really appreciate. But we did that. It was only a lot of chaos figuring out, but it was really good and really fun. And then other than that, I mean, it was my family and my partner's family, and we just had like a really nice little time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the best part about dating someone Italian Thanksgiving,
because
I am not a turkey girl. I'm not a stuffing girl. I do like green bean casserole. But other than that,
that's the Midwest in you. But
most of Thanksgiving food can kind of get fucked. No offense. No offense. Okay. I'm not going to yuck your yum. I'm yucking my yuck. But that being said, Italian Thanksgiving, you get meatballs, you get lasagna. I'm like, thank God I can eat something here.
Yes.
So that was fun. That was good. And I did cook, but I didn't cook most of it. I just brought like a little side dish to add.
Well, yeah, you always bring something on the side, but you don't have to do the whole shebang, because I'd have a like Christmas vacation type turkey, I think.
Yes.
Like it would like cough and like blow up probably with my
catch
luck.
Catch fire
but,
in the oven. Yeah.
But there is something very wholesome and nostalgic about having Thanksgiving at the same table that you grew up on.
Yes.
Like I grew up having family dinner at my grandparents' dinner table, which is now my parents' dinner table, which is where we had, so it's very sweet. There's something very awesome and nostalgic about it. And I feel really lucky that I could do that. We played cards.
Mm.
My husband kicked my ass. So
I would have kicked both of your asses at Rummy.
It's true. We did play Rummy and he got lucky. I don't know. That wasn't.
Fucking guy. Come on.
This guy. So I'm demanding a rematch because didn't sit right with me. So. Because I had him in the first half and
I've heard
he snuck
that before.
In.
No, I'm kidding.
You're sitting on aces and someone goes out and you're like, motherfucker. Not speaking from experience, just
no,
you
for
know,
a friend. For
I've
sure,
heard
for sure.
I've heard about that. I've heard how that can happen.
And how
and
it can
it's not ideal.
Wreck your whole thing.
And it really, you know, those that minus 30 kind of hurts. So but you know.
Anyway. That's so good. We also got back some wedding photos.
We did. I know some of you guys have messaged me like post them maybe on a story. I don't know. You have to like want it because you guys aren't here for us. You're here for like the cases and the story and the victims and everything. So I don't want to be like, oh, and by the way, here's
my thing.
Here's, oh, and this is me. And this is
but
about
also
me.
They're so cute and I love them. I love them so much. And then you guys can see what your favorite book characters look like in real life.
Yeah,
again.
Right. I guarantee you it'll be a disappointment on my end. But
no,
Abby
will
has
not.
Just the most luscious, lovely everything.
Oh, wow.
I was going to talk about your ass.
I know.
I know her ass better than her face.
Who doesn't?
That's a TV show quote. Get your mind out of the gutter.
God gave me one thing, and it was my mother's booty.
Mrs. Apple Dabble.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we should probably get into it.
On that note, yeah. So also with the holiday season, I'm excited to hop into it. So yoo-hoo, pod's on.
Somebody messaged us and was like, please make me a mug for that.
Yes. I'm so, looking at it, I promise.
All right, we're gonna work on it. Yoo-hoo.
Yoo-hoo, pod's on. So today we are getting back to our roots as promised, but I also promise not to make you sob today.
Thank
After
you.
After you did to me last week.
I am so sorry.
I'm taking the moral high ground.
I know I suck.
No, you don't suck.
It was bad.
It's bad, but we need to talk about it. And this one's bad in a different way that we need to talk about. But I think there's enough time and distance between us and what happened that it's a little easier to sort of digest. And it's a little less, you know, spit on your face, kick you in the neck, fantastic, kind of.
Yeah.
So, in fact, today's case might not even really technically be a case. It could. It depends on who you ask. But technically speaking, and very ironically, I might add, it is still cold.
Hmm.
Today, we're not talking about confirmed murder. We're talking about potential murder, arson, and the disappearance of five children from their home in one night.
Oh.
And not just any night, but Christmas Eve.
Aw, man.
And not for nothing, but I don't think it was Santa. Anyway, before we hop all the way into it, though, I do just want to hit my trigger warnings and sources for this episode. For trigger warnings, there is some mention of the Holocaust and Mussolini, but also revenge. For the sources I used, I took quite a bit from the Smithsonian article, as it was one of the first that documented everything in full. But I also used an episode from Morbid, from their 10th episode, Baby Morbid. Cute.
Oh, damn.
A YouTube video that's linked called Sodder Family, A Case Study. So I think that's all important. Also, some special honorable mentions go to NPR, The Register, Herald, and History.com. But of course, you can always see all of them.
Babe. So does that mean we're talking about the Sodder family?
Yes, we are.
All right. Context clues. You see what I did there?
I do. Look at you go.
Thank you.
So let's get back to the Sodder family, as you may have just guessed. But we're not going to pick up at the house burning. Instead, we're going to rewind a little bit.
Mm.
So we're going to...
Hey, you're wondering how I got here.
Yeah, exactly. But how we got here was actually immigrating in 1908.
All right.
Yeah.
Really rewinding the clock.
So Giorgio Sudo had immigrated to the States when he was just 13. He had come over with one of his older brothers, and his brother immediately left to go back. So at 13, Giorgio was alone in the U.S.
Did he move here from Italy?
Yes. He actually moved from Sardinia, which I'm like, brother, you got to be eating lots of fish there, huh?
Mm.
Maybe that's why he left. I don't know.
That's why the other guy went back.
Right. I will say it could have been in the year 1908 or 1911. I've seen two different sources on that, but I figured I would use 1908 as it was the one from the Smithsonian, and I kind of trust that more.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be either.
How terrifying for a 13-year-old to be in a new place where you don't speak the language alone.
Right. And your brother, who comes with you for the journey, just immediately turns back and goes to Italy. So,
which,
like,
is also expensive. How would you do that?
I know. So it's just him on his own finding a way. And Giorgio changed his name to George Sodder because, hell, you're in America. Why would anybody respect your cultural roots? Let's make that a little more English, huh? That's sarcasm. I think Giorgio was a way cooler name, but he's going to go by George from now on.
Okay.
So George is a man who was smart and ambitious, as a young man who emigrated alone to a different country ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
He worked on railroads, and he eventually even began his own company once he was able to afford a truck. So he would truck around dirt and later even like coal and freight for construction companies.
Hmm.
George soon met Jenny Cipriani, who was a fellow immigrant from Italy, and she'd come over as like a wee toddler.
Hmm.
So they were both immigrants from roughly the same area. She had been around the States longer, but like a really nice connection for them, you know?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh my God, she's like kind of pretty. I kind of like you. And the two fell in love and got married. And between the 20 years between 1923 and 1943, they got married. They grew their business, in which they now had 6 heavy duty trucks, which George would do all the maintenance of and take care of. And Jenny did the books.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 beautiful children.
10 kids, 20 years. That is almost constantly being pregnant.
Mm-hmm. So hats off to Jenny.
And constantly nursing.
And working.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did, though. And you'd have that many kids. And then, unfortunately, in that time, I mean, I'm talking more like the 20s end than like the 40s end, but still very regular, was like, not all your kids would survive.
No.
And not all your pregnancies were viable. Like, that was a very tough, tough time for families. Like, you'd have so many with the expectation or the assumption that, like, some just weren't going to make it out of childhood.
Yeah. And it's
horrible. Different times.
Awful. And I'm so grateful for all the medical advancements we've had, but also so grateful that this family seems so blessed. I mean, if you think 10 kids in 20 years, that is constant pregnancy, but also that's healthy kids all the way across.
Oh, the pain that woman must have been in from 10 births. I just, oh.
As I
look at that
pregnant
part of my life, like imagining like, oh, the next step, we would like children. And I'm like, maybe 2? 10?
10.
10?
10.
With no like epidural?
She's like a seasoned vet by the end of that. She's like, yeah, let's just do it.
Ma'am. She's like cutting her own umbilical cord. She's like, fuck it, I can do all this shit.
Right.
Oh, God.
But even with all of that, as you might imagine, in 1943, despite their American dream success story, love, and family, things were far from easy.
I imagine.
I mean, let alone pregnant for 20 years straight and working and raising and rearing and nurturing and breastfeeding and giving birth on just Jenny's end.
And that's not even the maintenance of the work and supporting all of that and your husband and
and him actually going and doing deliveries and being busy and keeping up with all of this. So like there's a lot going on for this family, but those are all good things for the most part. The family had made it through the roaring 20s and the subsequent crippling Great Depression. And then, of course, the Second World War was happening by the end of the 30s. Technically, they say it started in 1939. Okay, I wasn't there. I'm just saying what they said.
Yes, it did.
Hands are up. I don't know nothing.
39 to 45.
Some of us had crippling ADHD in history, and it was not mentally stimulating enough for me to pay attention and retain those facts. So that's what they say online. George and Jenny had 10 kids, and of the 10, 2 of the oldest boys, John and Joe, had decided to enlist in the forces and go fight in the Second World War. And if that wasn't hard enough, something even closer to home, or further closer to home, was going on, which was the dictatorship of Mussolini's rule.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you who, like me, like I just said, maybe had a hard time paying attention in history, or just don't know this part and time period very well, I have a very small section of what history.com gave me and what the Holocaust Encyclopedia gave me for what was going on with Mussolini at this time, so you can be as in the loop as I am. If you know more, let me know. I'm always into learning, but this is what I know. So Benito Mussolini was a fascist dictator who, despite having a relatively high approval rate by people, seized his power by force, eventually creating a pact of steel with Hitler, which connected Italy and Germany in economic and military support in the event of war. This was in 1939, and by the end of 1939, as we just said, World War II had started. As imagined, the connection between the two brought further staunch anti-Semitism and Nazis to Italy, and continued to terrorize not only cultural and religiously Jewish people in Italy, but also most people with a soul, as well as part of the issue with a dictator tends to be that in the fact that, you know, if you don't really want them, you can't really elect them out.
And you also can't say it because they'll kill you.
Yep. So you can't be loud about it. You can't bide your time and wait for it. You got to find something to do quiet, and it's got to be big enough that it does something.
Mm-hmm.
So A short history from the Holocaust Encyclopedia says there was a march on Rome that was staged the night of October 27th to 28th in 1922, which is what got him to be the prime minister. Then Mussolini, as the prime minister, was still dependent on the coalition government to remain in power. So he passed another law that designed to give him and the fascists complete control over Italian parliament. And of course, in 1925, Mussolini pulled off a coup d'etat where he ended Italian democracy in favor of a personal dictatorship, which I don't know all of the context here. I think it's very interesting that you could have high approval rates and be like, I don't want to rely on that.
Well,
I think that says a lot.
Is it because he was pretty much already in power? And so the,
he was.
I mean, were the approval rates really high, or was that what he was saying? Everybody loves me, so I'm going to do this. I mean,
you're not wrong.
I don't tend to believe what they say.
No.
But that's my conspiracy theorist brain.
So Mussolini was deposed by Italian King Victor Emmanuel III in 1943. And something I'd love to look into more that I didn't have time to in researching this was that he was executed by communist partisans in 1945. And people didn't believe he was dead. So they literally had to parade his corpse around publicly to be like, see, we did it.
Oh,
see?
People lined up to spit on him.
Yeah.
Like that's a real little moment. I like history. Yeah. So this stuff I did, this was like the only thing I did pay attention to in school.
So just very interesting.
I think I'd like to hope that some of my distant family got to spit on him.
I hope so for you.
A lot of mine were already here, but I got to think I had like a great uncle that was like in bleh. But really, that was a pretty significant point in history. And also the townspeople like wanted their shot at him.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, the starvation, the complete total like control. Yeah. He's a dictator. They all wanted a piece.
Yep. And I will say that it wasn't a normal holiday for the Sauter family. Two of their kids are enlisted and they're fighting. Your home country is under attack. Granted, this was, I believe, maybe right after Mussolini was executed, but that wasn't the case any of the months previous. And now Italy is recovering from that. So you are torn in so many ways. Your heart is in so many different places.
And what year is this?
1945.
Okay, so this is, all right.
The year that Mussolini was executed. But other than that, I mean, everything was kind of normal. Yes, things were weird in the grand scheme, but in the minutiae of day to day, what wasn't? I mean, George and two of his other sons, John and George Jr., made several deliveries with their trucks.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other children, the oldest girl that was home, was Marion, and she went to work at a dime store in town, which is just cute. And by the time the sun set, everyone but the oldest son, Joe, was home. I think Joe might have still been enlisted or overseas. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find anything else about their second son who was enlisted, so I'm gonna assume he might have been home since they only noted one was gone. But
okay,
Marion came back from work from the dime store and she brought like a bunch of little things for her younger siblings.
Oh, like little gifts for Christmas.
Yeah, so she gave everybody toys, which was very cute. And at like 10 p.m George and Jenny went to bed. They took Sylvie with them too. She was the youngest. She was like 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the others protested, wanting to listen to music and play with their new toys. And they were like, ugh, fine. Don't forget to do your chores before bed. Do your chores and then head up.
Mm.
So, you know, 10, 12, 13-year-old kids playing with little things their sister got them, listening to music. And then like, oh, I have to go make sure this thing's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. And they do it. And the kids, there's been a few different timelines because it's so long ago. But also, this has been going on for so long. There's just been so many interviews. And we just talked about how faulty our memory is. So some of those things have changed. But from what I can tell, it's like between 11, 1115 and 1130 that the kids go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that long. It's like maybe an hour and a half max. If they go to bed the latest, they said they did. And George and Jenny went to bed the earliest, they said they did.
Right.
So not super long. At some point, Marion fell asleep reading like a magazine on a couch.
Queen.
And even though she typically took on the role of like ensuring all the kids went to bed, it seemed like they all had gone to bed without a hitch. Everybody was in their little spots except for her. And she was just snoozing on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
About 12:30 a.m., so technically Christmas, the 25th, the phone rang and Jenny got up to get the phone. She heard a woman's voice with the background of what seemed to be like a party going on. And she asked for a man that Jenny didn't know. And so, unsure if it was a wrong number or a prank, she just said, I don't know, and hung up and went back to bed like a queen. This was later confirmed to be Mrs. Frank Harding, which I'd love to know her actual name. I didn't find that anywhere, but that's not really how that patriarchy works. So Mrs. Frank Harding had indeed made a mistake and dialed the wrong number, but it is kind of weird.
Interesting. Okay.
Before going back to bed, Jenny did like a quick check. She searched the downstairs of the home just to make sure everything was good. Everything was. The only thing that was weird was Marion asleep on the sofa instead of in her bed.
Which is not that weird.
No. No. And so she goes back to bed. But about 1 a.m., she got woken up again, and she heard what sounded like maybe a rock landing on the home's, like, tin roof.
Oh, okay.
Like, just a weird, loud sound. But initially, she was like, oh, I'll wake up George. And then she was like, no, it was probably just something falling from, like, a tree. Or, right. Like, an animal. You know what I mean? So she just dozed back off. But not for long. Because at 1:30 a.m., Jenny was woken again. Except this time, it was because her room was entirely full of smoke.
Ooh.
She jumped out of bed and she tried to go to the office, which, if I can give you a mental visual, you can see the plans on our Instagram. But her home basically has, like, if you can picture a quarter, like a room split into quarters, so four corners. Her room was the bottom left corner and the office was the bottom right corner. So it was, like, pretty close attached.
Mm-hmm.
And so she tried to get to the office to call for help, but the fire was already blocking her way in. And the office is also where there were two fuse boxes, the electric meter, and the telephone. So she couldn't do really anything without being able to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she obviously woke up George and made sure he was good. They called up the stairs to the kids, trying to get their attention to be like, hey, can you, you know, get the fuck up and let's get out? Mm-hmm. My words, not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they were managing this and figuring out like the level of urgency and also how dire the situation was, they were running out and they saw that the electricity blew in the meantime. So now the house had no electric.
Oh, geez.
It was just on fire.
Okay.
And although I will say this, it was only allegedly in one of her interviews that she said the electricity blew before they were out of the home, but it did eventually.
Okay.
So I don't know if she was like maybe forgetting because there's so much else happening. And again, trauma and memory aren't really friends.
Correct.
Or if maybe somebody else was in the home and she was just saying like the royal we, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So she woke up George, yelled to the kids. The fire was moving quickly, like fast. Because keep in mind, this is an old house. It was at least built between the 20s and the 40s. So they probably don't have the best fire protection. Their insulation, probably pretty flammable. Like, there's a lot going on.
Makes sense.
And Marion woke up and went to her parents' room to get Sylvia, the youngest daughter. And I think she was also yelling up to the kids. So Marion ran out the door. But also, John and George Jr. are a little less clear because they seemingly woke up from their mother's calls. And then as they were getting out and running down, they tried to get the other kids' attention before they left the house of like, come on, let's go.
Okay.
And granted, there's 10 kids, so they all share rooms. There's two rooms upstairs. One is the boys' room. One is the girls' room.
Okay.
And so,
and it's smoky and it's scary and it's hot and you're half asleep.
And you're just trying to get the hell out of there. So right. They're like, come on, come on, come on. I'm running. Like,
right.
But they did say, like, one of them swore that he heard responses from his brothers.
Okay.
But eventually, once people were out, there were only 4 kids out of the house. The other two boys that made out of the fire were George and John. So it was Marion, George, John, and Sylvie. One was gone, which meant there were 5 seemingly still in the home.
Ooh.
That's a lot of kids. So George is frantic. He's like, there's 4 of you. There's supposed to be 9 of you. Like, I know that much. Like,
Big George, the dad. Yes. Gotcha.
And he went to go break the window that led to the stairway,
mm-hmm.
but he cut himself so bad he couldn't keep going through it. And because the stairs were right by the office where the fire started, it was so smoky he couldn't get up them. Then he goes to look for another way. He goes to look for a ladder that should be against the house. It had been. They'd been doing work, I assume, on the roof or maybe clearing leaves off or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't find the ladder. He did like two laps of the house and was like, I know I'm fucking like frantic right now, but I should be able to see a ladder. Like,
right.
Ladder was not there. So George is panicking, still is like in parent hero mode, getting to my kids, goes and gets one of the trucks. But it's an older truck and he is so frantic that he chokes the thing so it won't start.
Oh, it's like quick thinking with everything. Yeah. There should be a ladder here. Okay, there's not, on to the next. Like, mm-hmm. He's really putting in a lot of effort. What? Okay, the ladder not being there when he knows it to be.
It's weird.
Is giving me a red flag.
So while all of this is going on, Marion, who I'm just going to say right now is the queen of this whole thing. Like, in the moment of all of this panic, Marion was the queen.
The oldest sister.
Yes.
Gotcha.
She ran to another home to use their phone. They tried calling, and the fire department had no direct dial, and she couldn't reach an operator.
What?
So Marion ran to another home, and they couldn't reach the operator or the chief.
Okay.
Yeah. A passing motorist, Thomas Smith, was actually going home when he saw the fire, and he turned right around to use a phone and call it in, but their phone was broken and he couldn't. So he then drove all the way back to another town where he was coming from, where he was able to call the fire chief. Get this. His name was Fire Chief Forrest J. Morris.
Forrest Morris?
Forrest Morris.
I love that.
Forrest Morris, the fire chief.
That Try would be saying a that children's book.
10 times fast.
No.
Literally. No. In my research, I just said, wild name, damn.
Yeah, but you're right. What you're was right. I on?
So Smith left with the impression that nothing would happen soon, even after calling the fire chief. Hmm. So instead, he drove to the home himself. Snaps for Thomas.
Wow.
He found it mostly collapsed in flames. Hmm. And there were other passerbys who saw and flocked. The fire burned through the night and still had embers when the fire department arrived. Do you want to know when the fire department arrived?
I don't know if I do.
They arrived like 7 hours later at 8 a.m.
That is horrible. So the house is pretty much in
the house pieces. Is done.
It's down.
It's down.
Yep.
And also
they're just here to like stomp out the rest embers of what's there. Apparently.
Yeah. And sort through.
Okay.
So I will say, in Morbid, they were like, 7 hours isn't even acceptable for delivery. Like, it should not be acceptable for a fire department.
We're at a point where we're pissed that 7 hours, like, if my Amazon package takes more than 7 hours right? to get here, we're like, hey.
Where is it? Yeah, so just nuts. But Fire Chief Morris came and found it pretty much collapsed in flames. Other people flocked by, and when they got there, it was just embers. Just embers left that they kind of had to put out and wait to set it out. Morris sent some volunteer firefighters to soak it with the home, and the Satters and the remaining children went to a small, like, two-bed shack that was somewhere else on their property. Mm-mm. Troopers R.S. Rule and F.E. Springer, I don't know their full names, that's all that was in reports, with Public Safety, which is now West Virginia Police Department, had arrived about 9:15 a.m. And Rules and Springer were the first to talk with George, Jenny, and John. And their report is like the first one that everything else is based off of. So most people take that as the most accurate because it was the closest to. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, this is still technically cold. Like, we still don't have an answer for you.
Right.
So by 10, most of the house had cooled to a place that it could be searched. You could sort through, try to find anything. And Chief Morris came back and told George and Jenny that there was no trace of their children in the fire remains.
Is it the five youngest children that aren't there?
It's like the five middle children.
Okay, so the itty bitties are out.
Yes.
And the oldest, Marion. Yes. So is she the only of the older ones that's out?
Marion is. Joe would have survived this, but that's because he wasn't home. Mm-hmm. And then there was, and the kids that were missing or presumed dead were Maurice, who was 14, mm-hmm. Martha, who was 12, Louie, who was almost 10, Jeannie, who was 8, and Betty, who would have been 5.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
5 to 14 was the age range.
But the oldest being 14, that doesn't sound like a calculated like escape from the family or anything. These are just kids.
They're just kids. And why would the 5-year old be in on that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's nothing weird with the kids in that they were wondering if the kids did anything. But there were a few things that were going on that really raised some red flags.
And they're saying there's no bodies in these embers here.
So
in the ashes,
there's a lot that went wrong with this investigation, and I want to point fingers, but I also know that we're talking about 1940s.
Yes.
And so I know there's a lot of technology we don't have. There's a lot of evidence-based practices that we haven't found evidence to base them on yet. So mm-hmm. those aren't happening. And even if there's any forensics, we had to go through a lot of pseudoscience for forensics before we found things that were really reliable. So even in the event that the best case was happening, the chances of this being sorted are low.
Mm.
That being said, there are things that don't make sense and they knew at the time didn't make sense. And we will talk about that. But it is interesting to me that within 2 hours of getting there, the police chief felt confident enough to say, there's no remains of your kids here. Mm. Assume they're dead. And the idiot advice that he actually gave this grieving couple was just get like 5 different piles of dirt from the house and like bury those.
Are you serious?
I am so fucking serious. 10 a.m. Christmas morning.
That is so callous.
Merry Christmas. Just grab handfuls
and
of dirt.
Wrong because I mean, yeah, a human body to like fully burn needs to burn at very high heat for a very long time.
And that's one body.
And that's one, not 5. Mm-hmm. And not in this home. It just seems so odd. So
it is.
We really don't think they're in there.
No. At least I don't.
Okay.
There's some other stuff we'll talk about. But the extent to how much this was all searched after Christmas is really unknown. And the extent that it was searched on Christmas
was minimal.
Minimal at best. And all volunteers from a fire department and public safety, which wasn't even a certified police department at the time.
Great.
So what we do know, though, is later that week, so Saturday, December 29th, Jenny's brother, Jimmy Cipriani, came over and he helped George bulldoze a lot of what was going on. They got a lot of extra dirt so they could fill in where the basement was. Mm-hmm. Just there wasn't like a giant freaking pit in the family's lot.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so I believe that some of it was the debris that they shoved in there, but I think they also got separate dirt to put in there as well to sort of like fill it in.
It's just awful because not only did they lose their kids, or at least they believe that they did, they lost every thing they had.
Well, and not for nothing, even in the event that this mystery is a mystery and not a murder and that the kids were still alive, they never saw their children again before they passed.
So they may as well have been dead.
At least in terms of the impact on their parents' life.
Well, yeah, but like also you lost every, you know, the very few photos you might have had of your children. Right. You lost those. Any records of like their birth or anything like that. I don't know how much these things were logged elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like your immigration paperwork, like anything like that was probably lost. And also just the sentimental things. And then you also have more than half of your children that you cannot find and you will never see again.
And you... Yeah, like even a death almost would have been easier for them to process because it would have been like, okay, I know where my baby is.
Mm-hmm.
But on December 29th, they also held a memorial service for the 5 kids.
Mm.
And initially, they sort of just accepted this as fact that they were like, okay, they're gone. This is really awful. This was an insane tragedy. The trauma has to be unreal. And while all of the other kids attended, George and Jenny were too distraught to go. They could not go to this memorial service. I mean, how could you? It's heartbreaking to see a parent lose one child, let alone 5, let alone 5 in one night.
I don't have words.
So after that, though, and I assume also probably due to bulldozing the lot and filling it in, the fire marshals didn't really investigate any further. And they didn't really come up with an answer either. They listed the fire as undetermined if it was like arson or not.
Okay. You show up 7 hours late and then just be like, yeah, that sucks. And then leave?
Yeah. And they're like, man, we would love to know what happened here. And they're like, yeah, us fucking too.
Ugh.
And not for nothing, but But if you're going to take 7 hours to get there, can you at least put in 7 hours of work?
Yeah, it wasn't even worth the drive at literally. This point.
So for the next 2 years, George and Jenny seemed to try to get on with their life and move forward and just tried to grieve and understand this loss and rebuild.
Did they have more children?
All you can do. No, they just had the initial 10, now 5. Mm. But that changed in 1947 when two weird occurrences happened that sparked their old suspicions that the kids might not have died.
Oh, okay.
Initially, I mean, truly, George thought someone set the fire the night of. Because he was like, this is weird. We've been up and around. Like, nothing was out of place. Nothing was weird. But, I mean, if the fire department comes to investigate and they say undetermined and that your kids are dead, you're probably a little more distracted. You know, with the grief and losing everything.
Right. But coupled with his wife hearing something on the roof and then less than an hour later, your room is full of smoke, just seems like something started this intentionally.
Yes. And quickly.
But did you leave like a gas lantern on? Like what? Right. Did you have one of those? Did you like a flame, open flame somewhere? Did you have a fire going? Because it's
cold. Yeah. I think actually there were at least a few fireplaces. I don't know if they were all lit, but I think maybe one was.
In what state did they live in?
West Virginia.
Okay. So.
The possible.
I imagine cold. I don't imagine. Not as cold as here.
No, but chilly.
Mm-hmm.
And probably dry.
And at night, definitely needing that. So that could be a thing.
But I want to bring that up just because that means this 2 years later, when they're finding out more things, this belief was not a result after grief. This was going on in the back of their minds this whole time. Mm-hmm. And just because they had other more pressing things going on doesn't mean that this came out of nowhere.
So they always kind of wondered if the kids were alive.
Well, certainly if the fire was started or if that was a goal, like if the fire was meant to distract from what was really going on, which was to target the kids.
Okay.
So in early 1947, an essay in Look magazine showed a photo of kids in New York. They were in like a New York school system. And George and Jenny thought one of them looked a lot like one of their sons, like too much like one of their sons. And this was just 2 years later. There wouldn't have been a big age face development difference.
Mm-hmm.
George and Jenny themselves went to New York, but weren't allowed access to any of the kids there.
I would have just waited outside of the school.
Right.
Like, hey, and call the name. Be like, ah, got him.
Right.
Because you know you're going to look.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like, my heart is so heavy for them because they personally investigated every single tip and lead that came in.
Oh, they just wanted to know.
They just wanted to know. And other tips came in, too. For instance, James Frame, who was also wild name. He was the reverend who did the memorial service for the kids. He heard a rumor that Fire Chief Morris had stated on the day of the fire that he found what he thought was a human heart in the debris and that he had buried it in their basement when they bulldozed and like excavated it back in.
What?
Yes. So knowing hearts are hard to burn for some reason, who knows this? I don't know, but apparently that's something he just knew.
Okay.
The reverend contacted the chief who confirmed the story. He said, yeah. Yeah, I did that. And then they told the Sodders, who were upset, like, of course. Mm-hmm. But Chief Morris was like, I thought I told you that. Did I not tell you that?
No, you didn't mention it.
I thought I told you that. So he did eventually go to their home and showed them where he buried the box.
He put it in a box?
Yeah. He wrapped it up in newspaper and put it in a box and then put the box in the home. If I was the parent, I'd want the only freaking piece of my kids left. Thank you.
And that's not for you to decide.
Yep. And allegedly, Morris didn't keep this a secret. He literally just thought he told them.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, there are documents that say he did and there was a witness. But if the two parents don't remember and we can't contact a witness, I am much like your conspiracy brain. And I say, that sounds like a CIA to me.
Mm.
Who knows? It's possible. And it's possible that he did. And again, trauma and memory aren't friends. But
I mean, why would you go around talking about it to everybody else but not the parent?
Yes. Well, exactly. And how did the rumor get started if he didn't tell someone?
You know, so like maybe he thought he did, but all right.
Who knows? So eventually the box was dug up and it was at the very bottom of the basement. Thank you for all that work, Chief Morris. Very sweet.
Oh, God.
And Morris did identify that as the box. He said, yep, yeah, no, that's the one. We found it. Great job. So they didn't bring it to the police, which maybe they should have. If there was a real police department around. Don't know how much public safety could do about it, but, you know, that would have been ideal practices. Instead, they brought it to Harold Gay's funeral home in Montgomery.
Okay.
And there was a signed affidavit on November 2nd, a few years later, so 1949, where Harold reported that George and a private investigator that he had hired had brought the box to Harold.
Mm-hmm.
And that he said in it, he did not see a heart. Instead, he saw a liver wrapped in newspaper. And from all of his training and best case identification, he believed it to be beef liver.
Oh.
So the liver of a cow, not the liver of a human. And the chief had requested part to be set aside and sent to the police department for testing. So the coroner was all for it. He like embalmed the liver. He put it in a box outside of the house. I don't know if it was the same box, but he put it in a box and he sort of let it set and do its thing out there because it smells bad. And then when it was time for it to get picked up, he said, okay. And instead he put it from like the porch under the steps in front of the home. But by the time someone from the police department or the investigators came, the box was gone. So no part of it ever got formally tested. No part of it was ever entered into evidence because it was gone by the time they got there. And the only theory for why that is they think maybe the sanitation department could have picked it up when they were getting the trash.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems mighty odd to me.
Yeah.
So they think that maybe after all of that, it ended up in an incinerator, which is like super helpful.
Yeah, I'm going to get a lot from that. Thank you.
Thank you. So again, with no formal identification made, no portion that was able to be tested on, all we have is one man's physical identity of a beef liver versus a human liver. I don't know how different they look. That's not my area of expertise.
Mine either. Can't say, but
I can imagine I would feel more comfortable if there was science behind it.
I'd have to agree with you there, actually. Yeah, I would.
But also, if he sees humans all day long, because he's a coroner, I also believe that he knows what a human liver looks like.
You would hope.
So George continued to investigate, and he looked into everything. He hired another private investigator. This one's name is also George. George Swain.
Mr. Swain.
Swain decided it was time to take their case public. He said, yeah, this sucks. This sucks hard. Everybody knows it, but not everybody knows it. So let's see what we can get. And maybe other people who haven't heard have a tip or have seen something.
I can understand that because especially if you think there's one of your children in New York, you'd want the word spread at least up that way.
Exactly. And so in November of 1948, a news article in the Charleston Gazette detailed the fire. It gave a full detailed account of everything up to the publication, and calls and letters started pouring in. There were all sorts of tips. And granted, I'm sure some of them weren't real. Some of them are always fake.
Always been those really awful people in society that just, I don't know, want 15 minutes or like causing harm. And
or have some sort of other mental illness that causes them to get messy in that way. But during the first half of 1949, after that article came out in late 1948, they were in and out of all sorts of media. The news, articles, all of that, where they're like, we need to know what's happening and what's going on with this case because this is fucking wild. And people decided to try to excavate the site where the kids should be resting. So presumably the house.
Right.
To go through the dirt. And Swain tried to retain the services of the former fire marshal, Thomas Brophy, because I think he was like, what the hell is Chief Morris doing over here? Forrest Morris, you know? However, he was too expensive. They couldn't afford him.
No.
Yeah. So They also had attempts to involve the FBI, which were also unsuccessful, with one very brief snippet where they were, but we'll talk about that later. Mm. So Sauter did himself. He excavated everything. He went through the dirt. He tried to find something.
That's so sad.
And they began on August 18th of 1949. And the assistant fire marshal came out that day. Hey, new person. Mm. And they found a lot of debris, but they also found 6 small bones. Which is the closest thing we have to anything at this point. So Dr. Hunter brought the bones back to a lab in Washington, where they were able to determine that at least 4 were human. And of those 4, they were 4 different vertebrae, lumbar vertebrae. I think they're lower. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the lower part of your back. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. But they did determine that they were from a child who was about 16 to 17 years old. Which was awful and a breath of relief at the same time, because it meant it was none of their kids, but it was somebody's.
In their house?
In the debris, yeah, where they filled in.
Well, right, but like that in that would have died in their home.
So the interesting thing about it, though, was that there's no evidence that these bones had even been touched by fire.
What?
So what they think is that it must have come in the dirt that George ordered to fill in the basement. Because it wasn't any of the kids.
It's just another dead kid's bone. Are you kidding me? What is happening?
Yes. And it's just like, oh, well, at least it's not yours. Maurice was only 14. But it's somebody's.
It's someone's kid. Are you kidding?
It's somebody's and somebody's who ended up there who wasn't in the fire, which is even more confusing.
And the bones weren't burned.
Nope. So authorities had always believed that the kids had to have perished in the fire, as there was no accounts on that night that the children left their home. Nobody saw them leave.
Right.
But also, Mr. and Mrs. Sauter said that they didn't hear him scream either. And not for nothing, but you don't die in an instant if you're burned.
Right.
Those kids would have made sounds. Mm-hmm. And 5 of them to be entirely silent for the entire night?
One of them being a little 5-year-old who would not have understood what was going on?
Nope. And the fire department didn't show up for like 7 hours. But here's the thing. In that 7 hours, apparently, and again, not a scientist, but apparently, you need at least like 2,000 degrees or so for an extended period of time to burn the remains of one body. Mm-hmm. They had 5. And there was not one bone found from any of those kids.
Yeah,
there were appliances that were still intact.
Right.
And like, yes, the house burned down to its ground, but that doesn't mean everything is incinerated. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So there should have been remains of at least some, if not all. And all they have is 4 bones from another kid they don't know. So here's the thing. There are conflicting accounts on the boys leaving the fire. Like I said earlier, so George and John said they either went upstairs or called upstairs. That's kind of conflicting in different accounts, but I don't hold that against them. One account says they could have sworn they heard one of the missing boys respond, but that was also only in one. And it's confusing, you know. Jenny said when she first saw the fire, it was in the office. So it would have been like, if you're looking at it, the lowest right corner room of the 4 on the first floor. And there, I do believe there was a fire pit in there, or like a fireplace. Sorry, apparently I can't think of that word. But if there's a fireplace, I would think maybe whatever they heard on the roof could have gone down through a chimney if they had one of those.
Okay, that makes sense so far.
In my head, I don't know. But this couldn't have been very long, because the Virginia State Fire Marshals estimated it only took 20 to 30 minutes for the whole house to go up.
I wonder what it was made of.
I'm guessing wood.
Super flammable.
Well, given the Chicago fire and the fact that that whole place burned down just because of how they built stuff, my guess is materials were not great. But that's not very long.
No.
For her to get up at 1:30 and have it already be smoking.
Mm-hmm.
To be out of the house, they only had a little bit of time. And even still within that time, you know, if you're hearing kids screaming, you know, if kids are leaving, like the two of them being Jenny and George, they got out fast and then they saw all of the other ones come out as they did.
Right.
So just very interesting. Jeff Adkins and Lonnie Johnson, who owned like a nearby tavern, made their way over to the property during the night of the fire. But what's wild about this is that they took a taxi over to the Sodders' home, and Lonnie said the building was too far down to do anything, but the two stole from them. They got like chain blocks and brought them to the road and threw them over an embankment, which I don't know why that's worth it or what that even does.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know. He was then arrested for larceny for this. He had to pay a fine of $25. Come on. Get real.
That's expensive back then.
But I know, but get real. Ugh. He pled guilty and paid the $25 fine. But what's crazy to me is Jeff Adkins, who was there too, couldn't be got because he was enlisted in the army and had deployed before they were arrested. But I'm like, you're already in state's custody. I feel like they could get you if they wanted to.
Well, they don't want to.
Exactly. But in 1952, Lonnie made no mention of being the one who cut the telephone wires in the Sodder home, but he did confess to that 7 years earlier, which is interesting because up until then, nobody said that the telephone wires were cut. It was just that it was cut off because of the fire.
Oh, so it could have been cut before the fire.
Very interesting. The fire marshal also said he would have needed a ladder to accomplish that, because the telephone wires were 13 feet off the ground.
And there was a missing ladder.
There sure was. So that's very interesting. So earlier, when I was talking about Thomas Smith, the guy who like drove all over to get the chief on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the chief was later interrogated about it, I guess, I don't know, questioned, he did acknowledge getting two calls about it. And nobody knows what he said, but Morris has said that he knew about it and didn't know if the fire department would respond. Because he either said it was the weather that was bad, it was too late to save, or he couldn't drive a fire truck without somebody else there. And these are three very weird reasons
mm-hmm.
to not get up from the pub that you're in to go to this place.
Precisely.
And this could also be, I think it was maybe a policy of needing two people in the truck and like maybe they were understaffed. But even still, I feel like I'd go.
I would try to help. That's your job.
Yeah, and you're the chief, so it's like really your job.
Really.
You know? But the actions of Fire Chief Morris only got weirder as time went on. No remains were found in 2 hours or less. And that was enough for him to say, okay, that's it. The kids are dead. They're gone. There's no remains, but they're gone.
Great.
And what is also a point of contention is that the first report makes no mention of debris at the scene. There's only two photos of it, and they are like very grainy, very bad, in very old newspapers. So even if we put them up, you'd probably be like, what the hell is that?
Right.
But there's not a lot of mention of debris, even though you can see it in those photos.
Hmm.
And not that that's a huge thing. I would assume if there's a fire, there's going to be debris. But I also know how report writing works, and it's kind of mind-bogglingly, boringly obvious details, and I would think that that would make it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Beckley Newspapers reports that amongst the rubble is fruit jars, the stove, bed springs, children clothes, and maybe even a dictionary from the boys' rooms. By the 1950s, four separate people all told the fire marshal that they had seen and even handled pieces of what they thought were human remains.
What?
But this was 6 or 7 years after the fact.
Okay, but if a dictionary survived the fire, you would have seen remnants of a body.
Correct.
So that, all right.
Doesn't make sense. And according to George and Jenny, it wasn't until July of 1947 that they even learned about remains being in the debris. When they were told of it, but also, there's only one article from this whole thing that talks about bones in anything that they found. And it was so briefly mentioned. It wasn't what kind of bone. It wasn't how big it was. It was like, there's all this rubble and maybe a bone. And then completely went on.
It's not even confirming it's human.
Right. And that was literally on like the 26th of 1945. So I don't know if that got lost in like all of the reports on it, or if nobody looked further into it, or what, or if maybe, hell, I don't know. Maybe that was the 16-year-old's bones. that they found. Could maybe be. Those were just kicking around the property. I don't know. But like, there's no further looking into that. Nobody does any other look to see if there's any other bones or what bones those might have been or from where. And also, then they never show up again.
But just where are the police in this? Like, the fire chief, but where the hell are the investigators?
Well, at this time, that was the whole problem. It was just a public safety department. I don't know if the town was too small to have a police department or what.
Well, that's
but a there problem. Was no literal police department. It was just public safety and the fire marshals.
Okay, so yeah, they're going to fuck it up. They don't have training. They don't have anything.
Oh, yeah, they don't have anything. But there are four general points of contention, and then we'll talk about theories.
Okay.
Because this is all we have. Like, this is truly it.
Great.
So there are some points of contention here. And the first is that there were no to minor remains found in debris. As mentioned, the only ones that they found were confirmed to be somebody else's, none of the children's. It was brought up one time in one article and never looked at again. And also, from chemists, we know that we would have needed a significantly hotter fire, about two times the average temperature of a house fire,
mm-hmm.
for a significant period of time to burn one body. So for this to have really incinerated five kids, the house fire would have had to burn at twice the heat that it did for significantly longer than it did.
Right, which means that's not true. It didn't happen.
So the fire was not hot enough to cremate five bodies. And there is a response to this. And the response was that the house collapsed into the basement and remains were destroyed by the fire burning for hours trapped between the levels. But the problem is the kids' rooms are on the top floor.
Right.
So there's not really much trapping them in there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. I've never been in a burning house, God bless. But I can imagine it'd be a lot harder to get out of the basement than the hot top floor in that situation. The third point of contention was that a ladder was missing and the telephone line was cut. The response by authorities has been that the ladder could have been removed by anybody at any time, and that the cutting of the lines had been questioned by everyone. We know that Lonnie did it, but why?
Yeah, there's no reason to do it.
All he wanted to do was steal some stuff, allegedly.
All he wanted to, still shitty, but all right.
But you know what I mean? Like, yep. There's no reason to cut phone lines because of that if that's really all you want to do.
Way to kick a family while they're down.
And the electricity was not off before the fire. So the two fuse boxes have been put in question as to, like, was it an electrical issue? Is this what started the fire? But because the electricity was on through the beginning of it, they don't think so. But the authorities' response is that they only needed... Only one of the boxes would have needed to be faulty. So maybe some of the electric was on that was connected to one that was good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's possible. Granted, I don't think it was started by electrical wiring. I don't think it was faulty wiring at all.
I don't think so.
So the origin of the fire can't be determined. All five kids, despite no evidence, no remains, and no witnesses to anything that happened, have been confirmed deceased by authorities and nobody else. And based on the last time that the five kids were seen alive and that it was in the home, and also nobody saw the kids leave the home, they felt confident in saying that. But George and Jenny didn't believe that until the day that they died. They believed their kids were alive until the day that both of them passed away. So they have three theories. The first is that the kids were kidnapped to be sold on the black market.
Oh, that's terrible.
And I know that that's like... terrible, but also maybe out of left field. Like, why? But this is maybe the best rooted in cultural fact at the time, because after World War II, there was a pretty big black market demand, for kids. Because so many people were losing their children, they were losing families, and now that the Great Depression was over, oh, we're allowed to have them again. But also a lot of people were having difficulties conceiving, and they were ineligible for adoption.
And also just like more hands to do the work, because so many people were lost during those years with the war, that
our homestead needs help. We'll love you.
I mean, it's essentially like abducting them for like slave labor.
Yeah.
But it happened.
And some people saw the cash money signs that popped right up in their head and they said, okay, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
So one theory is that one tip that they got that made them think that could be true is that there were vague reported sightings of the children after the article in 1948 that got really big.
I feel like the children wouldn't have been kept together, though.
Probably not. So. But the sightings could also never be verified.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe it's just another handsome little Italian boy. Right. You don't know.
If they were verified, we wouldn't be talking about this in this way.
Right. The next theory was that the children were taken and killed by a former employer of George as revenge.
That's pretty sick.
This is where I tend to put my cap in if it has to be one of these. I think it's this one.
Mm-hmm.
Solely because, first of all, his name is wonderful. It's Fiorenzo.
Mm.
F-I-O-R-E-N-Z-O. Fiorenzo.
Yes.
Yes. Giannatullo. He was a well-known local businessman who ran a jewelry store. And the reason that he's alleged to have been behind this was that seemingly he came to the home and made threats of burning the home and killing George's children.
Oh.
Which to me says, hey, you know how your house burned down and your kids are gone? And I, your former employer, threatened to burn your house and kill your kids? I think he could have been looked into more.
Probably should have been, especially if the kids knew him and they run out of the house and he's like, oh, come here for safety.
Yeah.
And then takes them away and kills them. But at least like it looks to the family like they just died in the fire. Like you pretty much covered your tracks pretty decently for the time.
Yep. And you might be asking why? What's the motive? Well, seemingly it had to do with the fact that there was some fluke in an insurance policy for the home and he would have gotten any profits from the house if it burned down.
I can't imagine something happening to an employee's home and then the work gets it, but okay.
I think he might have named him like a beneficiary or something. The reason why, I don't know, because no offense, even the bosses that I've had that I've loved, I wouldn't give my house insurance to.
I'm not, they're not in my will.
No.
No.
So like, curious, but that's a benefit for him.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he loved Mussolini. And he hated that George was very publicly, very open about his detest of what Mussolini did, believed in, and how he treated his hometown.
Okay, so I'm a big not fan.
Correct.
Of this other guy.
Also, the last thing that's really weird that for me sealed the deal was that it wasn't Fiorenzo's signature, but it was his cousin's, like his direct first cousin, that was everywhere after the fire. He was on the coroner's jury, which ruled that this was an accidental death for all five of the kids.
Mm.
He also was the informant on the death certificate and the death register for the children.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I think I know.
And the third theory is that the children were kidnapped by one or many of Jenny's brothers and taken to an area around Tampa, Florida. This doesn't really make sense to me, but this is the allegation that prompted FBI involvement, which quickly closed out after that. But the sheriff's department in multiple Florida towns looked into this, as well as the children living with Frank Cipriani, one of Jenny's brothers, and they traced records back to 1941 and stated that they were convinced that he had two of the Sodder children.
Wouldn't Jenny have known that?
I would hope so. But if they had been in Cortez, Florida, they left the state by 1951 when Maurice would have been 25 and Betty would have been 11 because they couldn't find them there any longer after that. So that also doesn't super check out to me.
No, I don't understand motive, so no. I understand motive with the second theory, so that's kind of where I
lay.
Yeah, that's if we're looking at the three, I think it's that. Maybe the kids ran away. I don't know.
Well, and the other thing here, too, is there are two things that aren't contested in any of the Sodder's theories, and that is that each of them believes that the fire was always a way to cover up the crime.
Mm-hmm.
That the crime was about the kids.
Yep.
And sounds also right. That there was no faulty wiring or fuse boxes that caused the fire. They think the sound of what hit the roof was like a small homemade explosive of some type.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say the name of what I thought it was, but I realized I know nothing about explosives and I might not want to jot that out there. But like they thought it could have been a bomb of some kind dropped down to where there's already fire, and then you're exploding fire other places.
Gotcha.
But I believe both of those things. I don't think it was faulty wiring, and I don't think that it was a fire that happened to impact the kids. I think something happened to the kids, and then a fire was set. But I also think in my head, perhaps the most realistic would be the ex-employer hiring Lonnie to help.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cut the fire lines, you throw the thing, you get to steal whatever you want, I get what I want.
Yeah, it just sounds like really awful people.
That's what I think makes the most sense. But there are two questions, and kind of detailed questions, that we're left pondering in any one of these circumstances. The first is that if they were taken from the home, how were they taken without anyone noticing? You have five kids between 5 and 14. They're in two separate rooms. And regardless of where you go to get them, there's two people at least that you're not abducting that you'd have to get by.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were at least two of the boys that weren't abducted or missing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the first floor, George and Jenny were there, but so was Marion.
Right.
So that's confusing in itself. In and of itself. And the window wasn't super long. It was long enough to do it for sure. But it seemed like it was probably between 11:30 to 12:30 in the morning. 11:30 at night to 12:30 in the morning.
My guess would have been that somebody snuck in and got the oldest boy, the 14-year-old,
mm-hmm.
and either told him it was Christmas related or told him that there was a surprise or something. Mm-hmm. And it was like, get your younger siblings downstairs quickly.
Got it.
And quietly. So that he's like in on it mm-hmm. because he's excited and he wants to do that.
Yeah.
And then they're taken from there. But I think that you could use the holiday to your advantage in yes. that way and be like, get the younger ones and meet here.
Right.
Be quiet. Don't wake anybody up. You're going to ruin the surprise.
Well, and that's possible. I also hadn't considered what you said earlier, which is set the fire and just wait outside for them to run out and take them as they run.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it is interesting how they would have chosen which kids to take.
Yeah.
Because clearly they chose, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like, very interesting.
But if where everybody was, like the ones on the first floor might have gone out this door, but maybe the stairwell from right. upstairs would have gone out this back door. Well, then maybe you wait at the back door.
Right. That is possible. Yeah. Because there was a window to get access to the stairwell. Interesting. But the second question is that if five kids were trapped in the house and died in the fire, if that is what we're saying happened,
mm-hmm.
is it possible for there to be no trace left behind? Far and wide, what I see is no, mm-hmm. or at least people that lean towards no. Could a burning home generate enough heat to simulate a crematorium for five people?
Mm.
We have not consistent results. And the only ones that seem to say yes are the ones that use the trapped in the multiple levels theory, and mm-hmm. I still have a hard time believing that the top floor would be that hard to get out of.
No, I think the kids were taken out before the fire,
mm-hmm.
taken away, which is, and I think it makes sense that there'd be multiple people involved, one to like tell the oldest. That's just my brain thinking. You get the rest of them down because the other kids aren't going to trust a random adult, but other kids will trust their brother.
Right.
So you just have to make that brother trust you.
Yes.
And if it's dark and he's half asleep, but he knows it's Christmas, he might think you're dad.
Yep. And even if your dad's old employer, you know, that's assuming that it's one person. But mm-hmm. if it's dad's former employer, then you're like, oh my God, I know this guy.
Yeah. This isn't a stranger. It might be odd that he's here, but you're 14 and I don't know, maybe dad invited Christmas, you over. Who knows?
Who knows?
But there's something in it for you. You might be able to just do that. And then you get the kids out and then you do then the fire starts.
Right. Well, in one letter from the Cincinnati Cremation Company in 1951, even said that it wouldn't have been possible to completely vaporize one set of remains, much less five. Eyewitness testimony says the house was consumed and collapsed into the basement within 30 minutes, which would have been the hottest part of the fire, mm-hmm. most likely. So 30 minutes is certainly not enough for that. Morris in 1950 said that he turned the fire hose on the burning embers. So ideally, there would have been something there you know? And lastly, I mean, the only other point of contention with the fire is that John, one of the boys, said that his family used the basement to repair truck motors. And George denied that any flammable parts or chemicals were stored inside. And nobody could confirm or deny like what was stored down there. Mm-hmm. But they did find 2 55-gallon steel drums. So perhaps there was oil or something in there that maybe he didn't think was flammable that ended up being, or was, and he didn't want to admit to having had that. I don't know. Mm. But clearly it wasn't the start of the fire.
But if someone knew it was there, like maybe your former employer, and wanted to use that
and take advantage of it, yeah,
and light it there and then just have it burn from the basement up.
Yep.
Makes sense why all the smoke would be the very first thing you'd see and then the flames later.
And then we have a few more tidbits that are just really bewildering.
Mm.
So as time goes on, the Sodders obviously continue to press the case. By early 1952, the investigation is still circling in the exact same place. Nothing new, nothing old. Another PI that they hired had quit. Also, the Sodders decided to put up a billboard that offered a $5,000 reward for anyone who could help find the kids.
That's a lot of money back then.
A lot of money back then. The billboard stayed up for years, decades even. In 1957, the Sodders distributed a pamphlet with 25 questions of various length about the fire and subsequent investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And they handed it out to anybody they could. Mm-hmm. Just to be like, do you know the answers to these questions?
Right.
Because we don't. And in 1967, this is the weirdest part. In 1967, a photo arrived to the Sodders' home in a plain envelope stamped from Central City, Kentucky. They opened this envelope, and in it was a photo with a young man that they believed to look just like Louis. On the back of the photo, it says, Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, Lil Boys, A90132 or 5 or something, like a string of numbers.
Hmm.
They thought it looked so much like their son, Louis, paired with the message on the back, that they hired another investigator to go find him in Central City. But the man literally never returned again.
That is so weird.
Now a private investigator is missing. And like, did he go missing? Did he just rip them off and never come back?
Or did he find something out he should not have?
Right. To me, this would have given some credit to the theory that Jenny's brothers took the kids, because I have a vague recollection that the thought on that was that it was connected to the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you were going around and putting your nose places it shouldn't have been, that's possible. But that's also discounting my favorite Occam's razor theory, which is that the simplest is usually right. And maybe this was just a shitty person who ripped him off.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
True.
Also, no other part of that theory makes real sense to me. So,
right.
I don't get it. Maybe the black market one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But even then, why so quick to do something hasty?
Yeah.
Anyway, George himself did go down to Central City because, like I said, they personally investigated every tip that came in as well. And he didn't find anything, which was so hard. And time came and went, and in 1969, on August 16th, George had passed away in Charleston.
Mm.
And a few decades later, in 1989, Jenny passed away on February 15th.
Oh, that's so sad.
And both of them maintained until the day they died that those kids did not die in that fire.
But they still never saw them again.
Nope. And the billboard that they put up was torn down just after Jenny's death. And now all we have is what people might know. And it's all of these weird ass conflicting theories. It's so confusing. All I have is the one guy that fucking said he was going to do the exact thing that happened. And that's where I put my hat.
The only thing that I can kind of point to with that theory and it being a little bit positive is that if the goal was to deprive the parents or deprive the dad,
mm-hmm,
of his children, because whatever kind of resentment you've got going on, you've made it so that the parents think that they're dead, or At least you wanted that, and it did appear that way at first. So maybe you didn't have to kill the kids if the goal was just to make it look as if you did. Maybe you just went and then like put them in, I don't know, up for adoption or something. Or
maybe we could combine too the black market theory and that one of like, hey, there's money to be made.
Yeah, but I wanted that to be like a, maybe they could still have loving families and maybe someday they could try to track down their, well, I don't know, knows? It's still awful, but like maybe they weren't killed that night and just not there. You know what I mean? Like maybe it isn't that, you know, I don't think they died in the fire, but it could be that they still died that night anyway, just wasn't there, just designed to look like that. Or maybe it was, as long as it looked like that, that purpose had been served, and so now you can
continue on or something.
Yeah, not have to harm them or something. I don't know.
But wild. That is the insane. Disappearance of five of the Sodder children.
That is insane. And then the other kids are just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Well, and that's the other reason I don't think that somebody probably could have come in and talked to one of them, because afterwards I'm sure they would have said something. But like, that's it. Marion was on the couch. She was downstairs. Mm-hmm. Jenny was up three times in the hour before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were just gone. There was a missing ladder. Telephone wires were cut.
And also, what would the significance be of doing it on Christmas Eve?
Exactly. I don't know.
If not to have a way to get the kids to
like
be in on something.
I don't know.
A gift. Maybe for just their to parents, rub it in
further.
Anything. Like, yeah, I don't know. It just seems all very
curious.
Planned.
Yes. It feels very methodical. And just kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'd agree with you there.
This was an interesting one. I chewed on this for a while because I was like, what in the hell? Between everything that happened here, I also personally kind of think the fire chief might have been in on it.
I wouldn't be surprised by that.
I'm sorry, took his 7 hours
time. Yep.
Even if you don't have a volunteer firefighter, go get a freaking bucket. Like, there's something you can do.
You could have showed up and you could have just gone and tried to find. It did not take you 7 hours to do that.
No.
You went home and slept and then got up and went.
You said, okay, bright and fresh.
Like he had Christmas morning with his family, and then he was like, oh yeah, and this one.
Yeah, because he didn't get there until 8. You know how early kids wake up on Christmas? It's like 4 a.m.
There's no way. He's definitely in on it, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't know. It's so interesting. And later in time, like, authorities have said that certain suspects should have been looked into more. And I would assume he's probably one of those.
I would hope so. If I were an investigator at that time, he would be on my list.
Yep. But I wasn't. So all I can do is tell you what they did.
And well, that wasn't great. Dear listener, what do you think?
Oh my God, let us know. I want to know. Put it in the little Q&A below if you're on Spotify.
Yeah, we'll have it. We'll have a little poll there for it too.
Yes. And also, if you wanted to send something, if you weren't on Spotify, obviously you can do that to our email or Instagram. That's also linked below in our little link tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where you can also see the people, the places, the things we talked about. I am sorry because this one is such a mind fuck and so confusing, but mm-hmm. also at least not sobbing level devastating. There's been a little bit of time and it's fascinating.
There's a chance they were all alive. It's just that they were separated, which is still awful and tear worthy.
Yeah. It's obviously sad and cry worthy. Just I'm not like snot bubbling in the microphone to you guys today.
Right. And not convinced that it was all horrible.
Right. There are so many chances for it to have been slightly less devastating than what it looks like at surface level and immediately.
Like, there's a thought to me that it's possible the kids were able to reunite with their parents,
mm-hmm.
but the parents were so afraid that something would happen to them if they found out that they reconnected, that maybe they just kept saying they were searching.
Yeah.
Because they know who was after. You know what I mean? Like, there's still a thought to me where, like, there could be good that happened that never came out.
Right.
And I kind of have to hold on to that right now.
Also, you guys, if any of you have, like, Italian grandparents and you wanted to ask them about their childhood, just to like find out.
Are you from West Virginia or New York or, you know,
mama?
I'm just saying.
And just if they have a weird story about not seeing their parents again after a fire,
just saying.
But that's what I had for you guys today.
Well, that was a thinker, and I have my theory, theories, and I think that it is slim chance, but it is possible that there could be some reunification that happened that was just never spoken about out of fear.
Fingers crossed.
But that is what I'm going to hold on to. I would love to know what our listeners think. If you are familiar with this case, you know how to reach us. We want to know. We want to know what you think.
Well, yeah. As always, everything is linked below. You can get all of our sources. You also have our link tree, which includes our socials, places that you can leave a review, contact us, also places to donate if you felt like doing that for the pod. I will just once again ask for a 5-star review if you are so willing, so inclined.
Mm-hmm.
And check out our Instagram. You can definitely see all the people, places, things we talk about. But that's all I got for you. Maybe you can spend some time on that before next week.
I think that's a great idea.
Because if I look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Jinx.